Welcome to Infill, where we talk about local politics and policy with the team YIMBY. I'm Laura Clark, Grow San Francisco.
Brian Hanlon, the California Renters Legal Advocacy and Education Fund.
Sam Moss with Mission Housing Development Corporation.
And today we're going to talk first about the ADEM election. That's Assembly District Election Meetings. So those are delegates to the California Democratic Party, basically. And Sam wanted me to say that it's, for the lay people, it's the statewide DCCC is the metaphor. But I think that that's still not lay enough.
DCCC is the bar.
We have a very, very knowledgeable audience. Yeah. So I think that works. But Laura, more to the point, why are we talking about ADEM? Is someone running that we know?
Yes, political climber Laura Clark is definitely running. You know, the funny thing is, I did not want to run for this, but somebody asked me to. It was like, oh, you know, and then I was like, okay, cool. But I get like one of the things that people say meanly about me on the internet is political climber, and I can say right now that like I actually get stage fright. Did you know?
No, I didn't know. I'm just imagining you in a Super Mario costume climbing one of those beanstalks right now, like into like the penny cloud level. That
yeah. I also will be at Public Works on New Year's, and so like let me just say that like my political career will definitely be endangered by what I am doing at Public Works on New Year's.
That's okay.
I mean, given that, you know, former D8 supervisor and now state senator Scott Wiener appeared in his leather gear during Folsom Street Fest. Like,
oh,
I don't think
pathetic.
He had too much to worry about.
Okay, that leather gear, it was a leather vest. Okay, I saw Canada.
Which showed off his 8-pack. I mean,
okay,
come on.
And only in San Francisco could a supervisor show up in leather and get criticized for not being the cool.
Yeah. You're like if your critique is why, like, wear your assless chaps, then we're in a very different political environment than most places.
I don't know if we already talked about how I ran into our favorite Paul Henderson, who was running for judge at Folsom this past year.
No.
And so he was out there, like, you know, with his little slate cards and everything, you know, trying to get voters in what I thought was like the perfect I'm running for judge, but I'm at Folsom outfit, which was this skin tight, like very hot t-shirt. Shirt that it was a Paul Henderson for judge t-shirt, but it was
leather.
Like, it was not leather, but you know, you could say he was making a nod to the fact that he was a Folsom.
He's a pretty fit fella.
He is very fit.
Definitely.
Yeah. I'm sure made it work. Okay, but let's maybe get back to the point here. So ADEM is important. Why?
ADEM is important because it's the delegates who go to the convention who then vote on California endorsements. So anything that's a statewide level, so for instance, Scott Wiener for state assembly, in order to get called the Democratic endorsed candidate, you have to be endorsed at that level at the convention. Additionally, they vote on like party plank stuff. So there's like a caucus, you know, all the caucuses that like there's a caucus thing on like the internet, or I forget what it's called, but it's like technology and whatnot. And so there's a guy running, Dave Cruz, who's really mad that open source is not something that we're really talking about in our voting machines, and that there's like the technology of the party and of the nation is really behind the times and makes us hackable. Oh, kind of relevant. So that would be a place where you could go and like get it in the party platform.
And maybe like more in our wheelhouse, the state Democrats do have policies about housing, and you would, and like you could be a strong advocate for having more housing in California, for passing laws that are going to make it so that like we can actually build more housing in the state.
Yeah, right? I think there's a debate about whether or not actually what gets voted as the planks really matters. I mean, you know, the Bernie-crats on the national level really worked really hard to get things in the party platform this past year. You know, I don't think that actually what's in the platform really matters that much. I mean, you know, I'm sure people really feel like it does. I think actually what's more important is the people who go to ADEM and to the are engaging in that conversation. If you're there talking with other, you know, people, insiders from the entire state of California, and pushing them on this issue and making it clear that there are people who really care about that issue, it's going to make them think differently about what the landscape looks like. So if you are able to get something on a plank, that's a good step, but it's more about signaling to other Democrats.
So that makes sense. So if you're making it clear that despite California's many, many housing laws, many of which have been around for 3-4 decades, that they're not working, then maybe we could get some traction.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is, like, nobody goes to convention and talks about, like, Prop 13 reform, right? That's just kind of like a boogeyman. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, if I get elected to ADEM, I'm going to go and force, and, you know, so the assembly districts is what they're based on. And you can go online, and I will include in the notes sort of the link so you can see what the districts break down as. But I really look forward to, you know, having other delegates from, you know, more rural and suburban places and being like, we're going to talk about Prop 13. And, like, I'm just going to...
The world won't fall apart.
Yeah, and the world will fall apart. And you'll have to admit that maybe it's just for corporate, but I would say also for homeowners, but we can start with corporate. You have to start thinking about the fact that, like, oh, I don't know, our state is going to be bankrupted if we don't fix this.
Yeah.
I feel like the more opportunities we have on a region, like you brought up, the more opportunities that people from outside of San Francisco have a chance to talk with people inside San Francisco, the better for all of California. We're definitely siloed in the Bay Area, and that's hurt everybody.
I think that's right. And I'd really like to hear what folks who represent rural districts have to say about Prop 13 reform, because, you know, it's not the case that property in the middle of nowhere is accelerating at a great pace. This is mostly a California coastal, you know, blue area progressive phenomenon. Now, that said, most rural people, well, like most people in the city, don't love paying lots of taxes. But I'm not sure that this would impact their tax assessment very much if we were able to get Prop 13 reform statewide.
I don't think so. I don't think it would. Not as much as, like, it's a third rail right now.
Yeah.
Like, the whole it's like one of the few things I think the whole state agrees on in a bad way.
You know, but, like, this could be an opportunity, though, like Laura was talking about, to reach out to folks that we don't ordinarily talk to, that even if they don't particularly care about this one thing, they might be willing to do it to stick it to other people that they don't like. Much like how the incoming Trump administration is talking about doing away with the state mortgage, the deduction for state property taxes for federal taxes. Well, why is this? Well, it's more taxes. Don't Republicans, like, you know, want to reduce taxes? Well, the folks who get the most relief are liberals in coastal California and New York and Boston and D.C. Like, all of the really expensive places to live in this country are the most liberal places. So Trump is going to be able to stick it to his, you know, liberal antagonists and raise their taxes. This might be a sort of way that we could work with some California rural interests to get some votes there. Of course, there just aren't that many votes where people don't live, so I don't know how well that will work.
I mean, you know, so it's 7 women and 7 men from each district. And I would say that it's people who, because it's an obscure thing, right? It's something, it's going to take place next weekend, Saturday and Sunday, depending on which district you're in. It'll be either Saturday or Sunday. They take place at different times. I mean, this is like hyper-localism. It's designed to be, I would say it's structurally designed to be obscure and something that only political insiders really end up knowing and caring about. And so therefore, the only people who go to convention are people, as delegates, are people who are, you know, movers and shakers in the party, you know, the kinds of people.
Political
climbers, if
quote
you
unquote.
Will.
Even the fact that it's two halves of San Francisco on different days, you know, like it's not even coordinated on.
I thought one was on
the 17th and one was on the 18th.
No, they're both, it's the 7th and the 8th. Okay,
we'll
don't
fix
fuck
this in the podcast.
Up. Yeah.
From there.
And it's 1:30, 1 to 3 or 10 to 12. So mine is 10 to 12 on Sunday, but the East Bay is Saturday.
Got it.
And they're all slightly different. And additionally, like, a lot of them actually, okay, this is another place where labor, you see the power of labor. So a lot of them are taking place at laborers'
halls.
Yours
is Local 261.
Yeah, ours is Local 261. The East Bay one is at the, I forget, some other labor place. But this is also where I hadn't really, we you know, spent a little bit too much money. I mean, it's not huge amount of money, but on having physical space during this past election cycle. And I hadn't really realized, like, having free space that you can offer to other people. You know, local politics is actually, it's cheap, but everybody's doing it on the cheap. And so if you can offer free space to people to have meetings, to do their phone banking, whatever, it makes you like a real actual ally. So we use that a lot to like
build bridges. Helped people with this space, right? You've asked other people to come in and use this where we are?
Yeah. So we've offered it basically to anybody. I mean, we even offered it to people who like are technically our opponents. And that's a standing invitation, by the way, anybody who is listening to this. Because
all of our enemies who give up an hour of their day to listen to the Union podcast.
Frenemies.
No, but like we had people who, I think we talked about this before, that like the Vote 16 people were supposedly, you know, they were kind of an odd, they weren't quite in either coalition. They kind of had to make it on their own, but they then became allied with the Prop N people, which was the immigrant voting, which was run by people who see themselves as our opposition, but I see them as our future allies because we're pro-immigration. So, like, eventually we're all going to realize we're on the same side on that one.
It was a progressive block, I guess, for lack of a better
description. Yeah, it's a progressive block. It's the progressive block that we are definitely going to, like, pull into the new urbanist party.
Yeah, I think I see the YIMBY party a little bit moving also towards them as well. I think that both, as the political groups in San Francisco get younger and younger, for lack of a better description, as the old people get older, I think most, you know, people are like slowly starting to come together for common goals.
Well, even if you look at our endorsements, right? Like we endorsed voting for 16-year-olds as well. I mean, it was a thing that I very much supported. Sonia in particular was super gung-ho about it. A lot of us still have memories of being teenagers and like being rebellious right. And not getting our say. And
or like to think that we're still.
I was
cool
very
teenagers.
Level-headed when I was 16.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not saying that I was a cool teenager. I was like a punk teenager.
You were someone who should have been voting.
Yeah, I should have been voting.
I was a jock. I was a pretentious jock. Yep, now I'm just a pretentious executive director.
That's so funny.
That's probably what it was.
Let's circle back to like ADEM and why it matters. Yeah, because I want to talk about one of the things that is why like ADEM really matters is because if you're doing it right with your sort of political coalition, you're on a slate. And each of the people on that slate kind of represents a different interest that's part of the larger coalition. So the fact that I was asked to be part of a coalition means that, like, we're doing something right and that matters and that, like...
And who is the coalition?
It's like, you know, you're, like, basic bitch mods. Like, you know, so, like, but there's a little bit, like, so Thea kind of... Thea Selby, she does outreach on sort of both sides a little bit, but she's she's with Walk SF. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Walk mm-hmm. SF, and she's done some stuff with the Bicycle Coalition. She's like a great like future urbanist. Like I can't wait for us to be doing more stuff with them. You know, Justin Jones, who got eviscerated on the David Talbot piece, my biffle. Mick Del Rosario.
Theodore Ellington, right?
Theodore Ellington, who is so... am I allowed to say he's good looking?
This is the name-dropping podcast. Yeah. I'm just trying to prove that we know as many people as possible.
Yeah, well, so we're going to like post it all eventually and whatnot so people will like get to know the whole slate. But so what we're doing is having like the YIMBY-endorsed candidates. So those are people who like are overtly YIMBY that we, you know, have your quotes and whatnot and we're promoting. And we're doing that regionally. So we've got YIMBY candidates who are running for ADEM, like in Berkeley, South Bay. And then... they are often each part of a coalition, and so they will then give people the whole slate card. And what's really good about that is that then they get to kind of like humble brag, not humble brag, just brag, I guess. To their coalition and saying like, you know, I brought all these people out, which then makes them more powerful within that coalition. You know, all of this stuff is about, you know, being seen as somebody who gets boots on the ground, gets people out, somebody you should cater to, and therefore your policies get advanced.
Which is also why you were invited, correct? I mean, like, that's why you were recruited, not just because Laura Clark is climbing the Mario Brothers beanstalk, whatever, but because the YIMBY party is growing.
Yeah.
And there are other factions in San Francisco politics that want to be aligned with us.
Yeah.
And being able to, like, turn people out, boots on the ground, that's been something that, what, Grow SF and YIMBY has been kind of early on. I feel like you guys are doing a great job. You're slowly, but
sneakers
surely.
On the ground, really.
Sneakers on the ground.
Let's be real here. Yeah,
you're right. Sneakers on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, like, everyone was really, I don't know, it's weird. You know, we've only been doing things for, like, 2.5 years is when things kind of got even a little bit started.
It's like 100 years in San Francisco politics years.
Okay, sure.
They're like dog years.
But I would say, like, you know, the first things we were doing was things that people said was impossible, which was getting millennials out to hearings on a Thursday afternoon, okay? So, like, I would say we've been criticized for not being big enough from day one and also told that it's impossible, that we could never do it. So, like, I'm sort of whatever about all of that. I mean, we're going to get, hopefully, more than 75 people out to vote on Sunday the 8th at 10 a.m. Be there or be square. And then we'll get mimosas afterwards, so it'll be worth it.
I'll be there.
Yeah. Okay.
I just think the more regional coordination we can do, the better.
Yeah, regional coordination, and also, like, you know, people have to hear the idea 14,000 times, you know, and adjust to hearing the idea. And so, like, the first round when we go out there and we're going to be saying things that are, like we said, the third rail of politics, Prop 13 reform, like, step one, you just have to say it and get people used to the idea of hearing it. Because most of these people, like politicians have decided that it's the third rail, and so they're not even willing to broach the topic at all, and therefore there's a whole slew of people who don't even know, like, who don't even know what Prop 13 really is, because it hasn't been a controversial topic because everyone's been too scared to make it a controversial topic.
Yeah. Well, and also it's the people who benefit from Prop 13 over time are going to become less salient in California politics.
Right.
We're becoming like a this, you know, more young people get involved in politics as more renters get involved in politics. We get screwed by this.
Okay, so let's pivot, because we've got our amazing affordable housing developer here who has donated small amounts of money.
Tiny amount. I work for a nonprofit.
Yeah. It's just like, you know, a ticket to a fun party.
So for the record, Laura and I are in fact shills for a nonprofit developer.
Yeah, thanks. That's what I want to plug here, is that
we are
developer shills.
Thank
for
you.
A nonprofit developer, Sam Moss, because he has donated small amounts to the YIMBY party. That's what
well,
we want for
okay,
us
but like, let's talk about this. The folks who have donated the most money to YIMBY allied organizations are people who work in the tech industry that don't have any specific, like, a real specific,
you mean,
like,
the individual people,
before us. Yeah,
not the Maximuses and,
well, but they haven't donated to us though.
What are you talking about? We all know that they've just been donating
$1 million. It's like, yeah,
no.
It's like total. And the thing is with Maximus, Barbara Sanya is a big deal wine collector. I really want to meet the guy. I've never had a conversation with him. I would love to drink from his cellar.
With Maximus and Rob, what is it, Rosinia or whatever?
Rosinia, whatever the hell.
So he donated. What he donated to something that y'all kind of worked on, right?
No, he donated to a PAC that then donated a bit to us for specific projects, which is like classic San Francisco politics.
Agreed.
It's like, you
totally,
yeah.
Everybody does it. For
everybody
sure.
Does it. I mean, Maximus, I'm sure, even donated Jane Kim. I mean, I don't know. I'm just gonna say that.
Yeah, you're good. We're
I mean, certainly a lot of developers on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, because they got to spread the money around because they got to buy everybody off. But they don't give us money. I mean, I don't
not
know.
Not directly.
They don't give us money because, like, they know that we are already advocating for pro-development positions. Like, they don't need to bribe us. Like, in the, you know, days of old in D9, all the developers.
So you're saying we should hold out on them?
Well, you know, the thing is, it's not
mean,
a credible threat, though. It's not a credible
want.
Threat because, like, we want more housing built. They're the ones who are going to build it. When it, you know, several years ago, David Campos would just direct donations to mission nonprofits from developers. That's how it worked. They would buy off community groups. They don't need to buy us off because we support adding more housing.
I mean, they would. That's certainly one way to look at it, for sure. I mean, you got to get your entitlements. So you give donations or whatever to, you know, local groups. I don't know that he directed it in the sense that
he directed it. I know of out-of-town developers who got up and left like, meetings from David Campos because he was, you know, basically demanding pay-to-play.
I mean, we'll agree to disagree on how like that all went down. I mean, if you want your entitlements, you ask the supervisor or whoever that represents the district who you need to talk to, and you go and you talk to them and you support them. I mean, that's the entitlement game, not just in San Francisco, but everywhere.
Yeah. But no, okay, but that is
the so this is the argument for if you want to get politics, if you want to get developers out of politics, you have to take the politics out of development. There should not
absolutely
be
right.
this pay to play nonsense. You should have the rules that everybody follows and they all follow the rules. And if you want to have nonprofits be funded by something from developers, let's have a like percentage impact fee, whatever that goes to nonprofits in that area, but like all of these nonprofits having the incentive to slow up these projects is just creating this fucking nightmare.
There's it's that, and it's also, as you said, we have developers donate lots of money to local politicians, to local nonprofits, because everything is discretionary. If local politicians didn't have much of a say over, okay, we've passed zoning, we've passed land use. If what you're proposing conforms to our laws, then either it happens or it doesn't.
Which is what
I don't
right.
get any discretion say.
Which
that's
is
the
by right.
That removes all of us from the game. So the thing is, when anyone tells you, when anyone like talks about, oh, developers corrupting politics, tells you this, no. You corrupted politics by making development discretionary, by making development inherently a political process.
That's a good point. I definitely hadn't looked at it like that. I mean, discretionary, agreed. It'd be great if, at least, if it was within the zoning.
Yeah, I mean, that's like all we're saying. I mean, if you have existing, like, local land use laws, existing zoning,
yep.
why does everything need the blessing of the local kingmaker?
I mean, I guess it solely from the perspective of the mission, mm-hmm. Eastern Neighborhoods or whatever, the whole Eastern Neighborhoods plan, to be, you know, you can be within the zoning but not doing an EIR. You can, there's a lot of things that went into it, and then the internet, which, like, speeds a bunch of things up, like Uber, Airbnb, like there's a lot of, I get what they're saying about how, yeah, this might be the zoning, but there's been a ton of stuff that have happened that no one took into account when we were making the zoning.
Well, sort of, but the Eastern Neighborhoods plan took, what, 8 years or something?
Yeah, like, I mean, I wasn't here. Was I was like 10? In college when it happened, so, yeah.
Well, but on top of that, the thing that's crippling the Eastern Neighborhoods plan is that there's not a Western Neighborhoods plan. I mean, and the thing that's killing it is the South Bay not doing shit. You know, we can have all of the local plans that we want.
I think it's
we
the plans that need
regionally.
To, yeah.
Redoing the Eastern Neighborhoods plan is not going to solve anything.
And
I'm
the plans
so
themselves.
Frustrated about talking about redoing the Eastern Neighborhoods plan. Like, that is such a time suck.
Okay, but let's be real. Like, the talk about redoing the Eastern Neighborhoods plan is the talk to stop development in the Eastern Neighborhoods, right? I mean, like, that's...
No, I disagree with that. I think it's... No, I don't agree that it's the talk to stop development. It's the talk to, like, stop having to let a developer go all the way down, not do an EIR, not do a bunch of things, and then you're, like, the 11th hour where you're a community person finally trying to, you know, stop something.
At the 11th hour, there are all the requirements for pre-application notification and community meetings,
right,
and all
like
that.
Like,
that still applies.
The people, and when they get to that really point, want. Like when a developer gets to that point, there's been like a whole year and a half where they're just using the rules that are in Eastern Neighborhoods, but they don't have to talk to anybody. They're telling their lender, we're going to make this return. We're going to do this and that. They're making agreements and promises that they don't even get to back out of, even if they want to.
Okay, so but then what is the alternative? That we should need to do EIRs for urban infill development?
No. I'm not saying you should have to do an EIR. I'm saying that I don't, like the Eastern Neighborhoods Plan, the plan, setting something in stone and then assuming that a city isn't a living body that's going to change. Like, I don't necessarily think that in general, the whole Eastern Neighborhoods Plan is good. Like, I don't want to redo it. I would rather have more general zoning laws. You know, that
I'd rather have more general zoning laws.
I also think
that's
you
fine.
Set yourself up to be like Eastern Neighborhoods only, Sunset only, Richmond only, you know, North Beach only.
I mean, yeah, I think we should have like the Japan style where you make the rules almost at a national level. I mean, the entire idea that we are pretending that the Eastern neighborhoods operate independently of just even the Western neighborhoods and operates independently of the South Bay, operates independently of, oh, my favorite people to hate, Marin.
So, Laura, that's a really good point. And it's really funny that so many of the folks who clamor for localism, clamor for local control, are the exact same folks who try to excuse everything that's happening by global transformations in capital, like mass movements, changes in technology, all of these vast impersonal forces operating at a planetary scale, and yet they think the solution to that is local control. Like, it doesn't really make any sense.
I mean, I think the local control is a really interesting thing to talk about because, you know, I think a lot of the people who have the louder voices in San Francisco want San Francisco to have as hyper-local control as possible, but they would prefer all the other surrounding areas to not have it at all.
I mean, that's the ultimate NIMBY, right?
Yeah, but we're the market rate housing and the affordable housing are two different things. As far as affordable housing goes, especially now the redevelopment's been gone for a few years, San Francisco's doing way more than we need, like, that we're supposed to do, forget that, like, way more than anyone thought we would be able to do, you know, in a post-redevelopment world. And so I think that's the basis of why some people think that we should be exempt from, like,
well,
a buy-right
legislation. San Francisco is doing more of that because San Francisco has gotten so much richer because of the second tech boom.
Yeah, no, I mean, yes, but then that you're saying exactly that we're doing exactly what we should be.
Well, I'm definitely not saying that we're doing what we should be. I'm saying that there's a lot more money for affordable housing development because of the second tech boom.
Yeah, well, there definitely is.
And I would pile on to that. If we had a fundamental belief system in our policy making that the goal was to create as many units of affordable housing as possible rather than this obsession with percentage, then we could have so many more units of affordable housing being built right now.
We definitely could. You're right. You're right about that for sure.
No, Sam, I do have a question for you though, because you mentioned something and I think it's correct where you said that many folks, especially in the affordable housing world, really do want to see local control for San Francisco, but want to see more of a state control for everyone else. So, like, those jerks aren't doing anything. We're doing some stuff here. And certainly
we're doing more than some
stuff. San Francisco, okay. San Francisco, I think, is doing a pretty terrible job. That said, we're doing a much better job than, say, you know, Cupertino or Marin or many, many other places in the Bay Area. That said, where are they? You know, like, Sonia and I go down to help out affordable housing developers in the outskirts of the Bay Area to try to overcome NIMBY opposition, to threaten lawsuits, to do all the rest. Where are the San Francisco-based housing activists that say, we don't want market
Sam,
right here?
Sam, you can't ask Sam that, because Sam is, like, the good guy.
No. This isn't against Sam, but you're in this world more than we are.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying. Like, why can't they go down there and help out?
Well, and, like, we do invite them, right? Like, yeah. It's not like they're not here.
When we talk about redevelopment going away,
yeah.
When we talk about HUD being at 1970 whatever funding levels, mm-hmm. like, that affects us the most. Yeah. And I think that, and I hate to speak for the entire industry, but from Mission Housing's perspective, we have a finite amount of resources and sanity. And it takes everything that we have to make it happen in San Francisco. So I believe that a lot of people think that if they were to take something away from the struggle here, that it would diminish here and they would be lukewarm outside of San Francisco. So, like, both wouldn't be as high quality as they want. And, you know, you have a Forest Hill in San Francisco that might as well be San Diego. Doesn't want their affordable housing.
Sure. And what happened in Forest Hill, right? Who are the strongest advocates for below market rate affordable housing at the Forest Hill meeting? It was the young YIMBYs, while Peter Cohen sat silent.
And I, you know, like, no comment. I agreed. That's frustrating, without a doubt. But, I mean, I helped the Housing Action Coalition do a bus tour a few days later with a lot of people from Forest Hill. There were other nonprofit developers there. Like, I can do that. And I do hope that other nonprofits move outside of San Francisco, but I think it's something that isn't going to come that quickly because of the fact that San Francisco's always been this island, not a literal island. I mean, I I'm bad at geography, but I know we're not an island. Yeah. But it's always been, you know, like even when redevelopment existed, it was us in San Francisco only. And we tried to stay here and get all the money.
I just want to say, like, I actually don't think that we, like, your job, frankly, to me, is to build as many units of affordable housing as possible.
I'm on it.
Yeah, and I don't, like, from somebody who wants units to come on the market, from somebody who, you know, I'm friends with people who live in affordable housing units, and they need those units, and more friends of mine could be living in units like that. The waiting list is years long. I want as many of those units to be built as possible. I don't think it's a good idea for us to be asking affordable housing executive directors to be hauling their ass down to fucking Brisbane to be advocating for all of these projects. What I want to see is maybe the, you know, Peter Cohen type, right? The choo-choos to be, because that's what they're supposed to be thinking regionally. They're supposed to be advocating for the general, you know, affordable housing legislation. Great for them to be doing this. I would also love for, but I think it's an impossible ask. I actually am, I mean, we were going to keep asking, but I think that it is too hard to ask a Mission Housing activist who is fighting for what they feel like is the last chance for them and their family to be living in this city, to ask them to come and advocate for like a Western Neighborhoods Plan and sort of create in their mind this abstract idea that the Western Neighborhoods Plan is going to fix what they see as the flaws in the Eastern Neighborhoods Plan. I mean, I don't know. I think that's a big ask.
It's a big ask, but I'm going to push back against that line of thinking a little bit. So if you've been to any radical lefty protest, you know that everything comes to play. Like, if it's a protest against the Iraq war,
it's for affordable housing also.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, like, gets in there somehow. We're talking about settlements in the West Bank, right? I mean, like, there's, like, a lot of stuff that doesn't seem directly germane.
So you're saying because, we should just make it all more fuzzy.
Well, no. What I'm saying is that this sort of notion of, like, a vast interconnectedness of systems of oppression is not a foreign concept to left-wing activists. So, and Sam, I do hear you, you know, maybe the staff of Mission Housing, whatever, like, maybe,
yeah,
like,
don't,
like,
do anything,
they don't have time
units,
yeah, you know, just building us the mission, do
maintain
your good work
units and build
trying
units.
You're doing a great job.
Thank you.
You know, I understand why you don't have tons of time to go down to Cupertino at their city council meetings or what have you. That said, look, there are plenty of housing activists in the mission and elsewhere in the city that could spare a night a month in order to leave San Francisco, especially if Yimbys are offering to arrange transportation, right? So that's
definitely,
it's not that much of an ass is what I'm saying. Like, that, like, the time commitment that I'm thinking of isn't that huge.
I think it's the fact that if 300 units get built above the Milbrae BART station, or if 4,000 units get built in Brisbane, that helps
those
people
are on the
at
table,
24th
by the way.
And Shotwell.
Yes,
just as much as 160 affordable units at 1950 Mission does.
Yes.
But that's a foreign concept to the majority of human beings in San Francisco, because we used to live in a state that could properly fund a lot of affordable housing. We built a Bay Area that doesn't talk to each other. Like,
that's
why
true.
Don't we have an Amtrak system like the East Coast? We have a bunch of towns that are the same length, you know, from each other. We've built a society that's siloed in its grandest sense of the word. Like, redlining truly works. Just look at the Bay Area. And I think that that's the issue. Not if they have time. You are trying to convince people who's have generations have been told, just your area, just focus on your area. We'll put the jobs in Brisbane, but they'll build the housing in San Francisco.
But that's a structural problem. That's a political structural problem. Whereas East Coast cities incorporated around the turn of the century into larger regional governments, San Francisco did not. Mm-hmm. And that's the question for us is it possible? I think this is a long term, this is a 5-25 year project, is how do we, because we're going to have to incorporate regionally, it's non-optional. So do we do that through lawsuits? Do we do that through statewide legislation? Do we do that through convincing all of these townships that they really need to, you know, buy into the whole ABAG MTC thing? You know, that's an open question, I think, for us, and we're gonna have to be pushing that on all three tracks. But it's mandatory, you know, we're gonna die if we don't. Well, I like the, like, Ben, did we talk about this before? The Ben Franklin, right? Unite or die. Well, right?
The thing is, like, we don't quite need to dissolve municipal incorporations in order to solve this problem. Like, what we need to do is to
take
have
away
certain,
their power.
Well, certain powers. Like the thing is, look, there's a lot of stuff that individual localities do. It's not all land use planning, although that is a big part of it. Most of the reforms that we're talking about right now aren't even taking away local land use planning away so much as taking away the discretion to say no to projects that accord with their own local land use plans.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that we can move some of that stuff to the state level, I think is totally doable, even given existing institutional arrangements.
Okay, but if you do that, right, which we're going to be doing, the next thing that they do is they change their zoning laws in order to shrink the allowable because they cannot fathom a universe where they suddenly have twice as many students in their school district,
but
right?
That...
Because they are unable to, and this is going to be, it's going to be a kicking and screaming kind of a situation. And I think, you know, we have to think about how that one of the reasons that they are fighting all of this in Brisbane, right, is because they can't imagine their town doubling.
But this is also, so Brisbane is, I think, a special case because there, we are literally talking about doubling the population of a municipality. But look, that's why we have a whole host of housing laws, including housing element law. They still need to zone under existing state law sufficient land to accommodate regional population growth as determined by the Council of Government allotment. So in the Bay Area, that's the
great acronym.
Regional Housing Needs Assessment that is done by the Association of Bay Area Governments, which is the Council of Governments for the Bay Area. So there is a real limit to this, to how localities
can
downzone.
Well, assuming Scott Wiener can add some teeth to the RHNA numbers.
Well, but so that would be great.
RHNA is RHNA.
Yes.
Regional
Housing Needs Allocation. So what, you know,
I'm just saying,
I've heard
it's
that
all
argument
connected.
Like before. It,
yes.
It is all connected, which is what I was saying earlier,
yes,
right? Like,
yes,
why do,
yes,
all these lefties
we're
are like
be
super
crazy people
knowledgeable
with the strings and the photos?
yeah. Like the
No, you know. So this is a David Talmadge wanted me to come and talk to all the Vision SF people. And he, after the article came out, he still was like, "No, this is like a conversation. I want, you know, refreshingly honest, Laura Clark."
You are refreshingly honest.
Yeah, because I can't keep my mouth shut. So, you know, I just love the idea of me coming and doing a Vision SF presentation that's basically just a bunch of photos and strings and me being like, it's all connected.
Oh, I guess.
Here's the thing that would speak to how they think. I'm telling you, that is like,
yeah,
like rather than making like a linear type clear argument,
no.
Like, no, it's all connected. International capital flows, VC investment leading to jobs booms, leading to this. Like, that's how to do it.
Oh, but they got so mad at me when I talked about how police lack of empathy is tied to them not living in the communities that they police, and that is tied to the housing crisis. I have never gotten such a death stare in my life.
Laura, I was, maybe you don't recall, I was with you at that city council meeting where you said that, and that really was beautiful.
This was at this Board of Supervisors, so we were going to be talking about... what project? Was it the Brisbane project?
We were going to talk about Brisbane, I think.
And they were like, oh, you can't talk about that one because of like whatever obscure parliamentary rules. And then we decided, okay, well, we were at this very long, actually really emotional hearing on police oversight.
It was about the Blue Ribbon Commission.
Yeah, and their findings. And oh my God, it was intense. And so I got up and Aaron, this is one of the times when Aaron Peskin runs over to London Breed's elbow in order to make sure that he can bring the parliamentary hammer down upon me.
So good at the parliamentary hammer.
And so I said something like, you know, that part of the big structural problem is that people do not live in the communities that they are policing. And so they don't understand those communities. They don't live them. And that ties into the housing crisis. We don't have middle-income housing. Police officers are not able to live in those communities.
Everybody agrees with that, right?
Right, and well, then I said it's all connected, and everyone like was like, okay, great.
Well, some people were like that, but you did get an applause from a number of people in the audience who were there.
Like
who
you
were,
and one other person?
No, seriously.
Well,
like,
they didn't know
folks
that I was
that
supposed to be their enemy.
Yeah, no. Folks who wanted to implement the recommendations from the Blue Panel
I think most people do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people, the thing is, this is why I have to just keep to fucking talking over and over and over again and say the same things over and over again, even if it's really repetitive. Like, I was just, like, being trolled on Facebook earlier today.
Had to bring it up.
Yes. No, but I think that's worth talking about, right?
Yeah, somebody's when Laura says she's trolled, she continually engages, then responds, there's
okay,
lengthy
but
conversations
then I
with
win,
people.
Because, like, somebody says something nasty, being like, well, I support rent control, and I'm like, great, so do I. And then they're like, well, I also support, like, you know, blah. And I'm like, yeah, me too. I support places for families to live. And they're like,
so
well, fair enough.
Basically,
and I'm like, wah-ha-ha-ha.
You're getting into a lefty dick measuring contest, and they're like, oh shit, we're the same size.
Yeah, exactly. And then I win because they like me. That's what real winning,
winning.
Is. Winning. Okay, so speaking of national conspiracies, we should probably pivot to Ben Carson because we said we were going to talk about that. And,
great guy.
Yeah.
Great guy.
Yeah.
Talented hands. Yeah.
A lot of people are saying it. A lot of people are saying he's a great
guy. A lot of people are saying he has lived in a house.
A lot of people. As you drink your latte.
First of all,
right,
it is. Please, dude.
It's
I'm
a latte,
latte drinker. Let's
latte.
Be real. No, I'm drinking a basically chocolate candy with a bunch of Jameson. So I've.
Yeah, Jameson is the drink of choice on tonight's podcast.
But to stay warm.
Yeah.
The Yimby office is freezing.
If they want to fund us, you know, we could definitely use some sponsors for this podcast. So just saying, Jameson, shout out. We need some really
okay.
Wait,
but our funders have exquisite taste. Ben Carson is gauche. So back to HUD. Okay,
we'll
no,
have to
I think that there is
decide if it's actually funny later.
Yeah, yeah. For us, it is.
But I think there has been a bit of a disagreement between Laura and I about how significant that we think Ben Carson and Trump's HUD is. So my position is that Ben Carson is horrible. He's going to be bad for HUD. But so has every Republican nominee that are every Republican appointee for HUD. They don't care about fair housing. They don't care about integration. They don't care about inclusion. They don't care if the organization works well. They don't care about funding levels, but as the executive appointee, they don't have much of a say over that anyways. That's what Congress does. Yes, that's the problem, though. The problem isn't Ben Carson. The problem is that the Republicans control Congress.
I mean, I think that one thing to know is that we were talking about it earlier. Ben Carson is more the norm since Reagan. Appoint someone who doesn't know what they're doing.
You think he's norm Democrat
Republican? No, I think it's important to remember to keep in mind that Clinton screwed HUD more, arguably, just as much as, if not more, than any Republican.
People forget how much Clinton fucked up.
And, you know, I'm saying that the last two HUD secretaries under Obama were an anomaly. Two people who knew what they were talking about, had affordable housing or fair housing experience nationally, locally, statewise. That has not been the norm since Reagan.
So since Reagan, so fair. But, like, let's be real here. Even Donovan... has not been anywhere near as assertive in what HUD can do as George Romney, Nixon's appointee.
Yeah.
Who was, you know, really sincere about integrating neighborhoods. Now, of course, the criticism for George Romney is that he was so insanely wealthy, he had removed himself from any concerns of racial integration by living in, you know, some palace somewhere. But
I think that
I don't mind hypocrites so long as they're doing the right thing.
I agree.
I mean, I think you bring up a good
point. As long as they're advocating for the right policy.
Yes.
But I think, you know, like HUD, fair housing HUD, HUD Carla suing Lafayette HUD, and HUD that helps Mission Housing have its hundreds of Section 8 subsidies are not, I mean, they're the same federal entity, but they're very separate. You know, I think that Carson, I'm scared about how he blatantly has admitted that he doesn't believe in integration and fair housing. But, you know, I'm hoping that the amount of debt that's being serviced from the Section 8 subsidies nationally, you know, I'm a firm believer in the fact that the banks pretty much run the world. And they have a lot of loans out that need to get serviced. And so at the bare minimum, I'm cautiously optimistic that we can weather the storm for the affordable housing that exists. You know, I don't want Mission Housing to default on all of our loans because we stopped getting our hundreds of Section 8 subsidies, which would happen.
Well, that would happen, though. That's not a HUD call, though, right? That's a Congress call. Like,
it's a Congress call. It is. But, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, Carson is emblematic of a much worse yes. big thing.
Sure. Like, Carson is emblematic of the Republican approach to fair housing and to affordable housing. Yep. But Carson himself strikes me as, like, irrelevant.
From a fair housing standpoint, it's horrible. I'm really worried
yeah,
about it.
Yeah. I mean, he calls it, what's the term you use? It's social engineering.
Okay, but that's the talk that all Republicans use, though.
I guess. I mean, it's true. This is the question I guess we go back and forth about the entirety of the Trump administration is, like, how much do you freak out about this versus, like, a regular Republican? The part that concerns me is the kleptocracy angle. I do think that not by actual decisions, not actual policy changes, but by a complete disregard for doing things honestly and above board, you could see a lot of funding mm-hmm. diverted from Section 8.
So I think that's a good point. What you might see in a Trump administration is thievery, instead of from, say, a George W. Bush administration, where you saw, you know,
A total,
you know, we don't care about affordable housing.
Right, like
we don't care
only.
About yeah. inclusion. Like, we don't care about fair housing. But again, like, that's probably different than, well, I don't know. Ben Carson is kind of a swindler as well. He's, like, lent his name to all
I think
scams.
It really depends on the staff. Carson's one person. I think it depends on who gets to stay and who doesn't, you know, yeah. at the federal level especially.
So I've got a question for you. You often see high-level civil servants decide to retire if someone takes office who they really don't like. What are your thoughts on this? Like, I don't think this needs to be like a collaborationist versus like a resistance narrative, but for the type of, you know, people who are civil servants, not political appointees in an organization like HUD that have some policy-making authority.
Oh, I have a big
what should
opinion
they do?
About this.
I mean, I get it. Standing up for what you believe in. Leaving, you know, personally, I don't know. I've never been in that situation, but I think that I would hope that I would stay
yeah.
and try to resist it or, mm-hmm. or not resist. I hope that I would stay and try to navigate the flow that is going to flow regardless of what I do.
Well, maybe and change direction a little bit, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, in the positive way, but all I'm saying is say you quit, say you're really high up and you quit. There are so many other people who are just chomping at the bit to take that position that they will
have
say,
integrity.
I can be the one to go and do it and change the world, you know? And that's exactly what Trump wants. He wants a bunch of people to quit because he nominated or appointed, whatever, Carson, so that all these new people will come in and they don't remember the Obama administration. They don't remember positive stuff. And they'll kind of just follow the party line. That's my biggest worry.
I don't think you should quit in advance. I think that the thing that we should that I hope people are doing is ahead of time drawing, you know, their personal line in the sand and saying, I'm going to work hard and do these things, and when I am asked to do something that I feel like is betraying my country, that is when I will publicly rage quit. And I think that we can take a lot of inspiration from Kate Downing, that her rage quitting had consequences for that election. And I think that is exactly the kind of thing. And maybe it's not going to have an impact on Trump because he's unshameable, but it could shame the Republican Congress. And I think that the best we can hope for is that we are going to peel off some more and more Republicans. You know, I'm mm-hmm. just saying,
I don't know. That was the Hillary Clinton strategy, though, right? Which was that I am going to spend all
different.
Of my paid advertising on trying to show what a buffoon Trump is in order to go after those reasonable Republican voters, and that did not work at all because there aren't that many reasonable Republican
voters. I think this is more like people leaving because of something that actually happens.
Yeah,
like people leaving because things actually happen. Then everyone's like, "Oh, that'll never happen. He'll never be that crazy." And then when they do happen, you know, like some more moderate.
But then if someone rage, I mean, do we think that the House GOP is very shameable? I mean, like if someone like rage quits.
If then, 10 people then rage quit, if 20 people rage quit, if you create a system where you have a march of scandal, it's week after week after week
that
of
was
scandal.
The election, though.
Okay.
I mean, like, that was the election.
Trump is not shameable, and I would say that, you know, there's a certain smaller than 50% of the... I don't know that we know... Why? I don't know.
I hope the HUD staff doesn't quit.
Either, but I also hope that when the democracy... I don't know. I mean, do we have a study? This is the thing I've been asking, like, historian-type people, and, like, I have friends who work at Vox, who, like, I want them to do, like, what countries came close to falling into a tyranny but then pulled it back, and what were the things that actually worked to pull it back? Because I think we are at one of those tipping point moments where we could either, you know, descend into authoritarianism or we could pull it back, and we need some guidance, because I feel like all I know are the cases where people stood in opposition and then Hitler.
Yeah, right. That didn't work. So, okay, like, that's a really good...
Right.
I think that's a really good question. I think, though, this idea of, you know, rage quitting, make it public, get 10, 20, 30 high-ranking people to quit, or however many, I think that presupposes that norms still matter. And I don't think they do. Like, I don't think our institutions are strong enough.
But if norms don't matter, I think norms matter. They're like the fairies, right? Where if you believe in them, they exist. And if you stop believing in them, they, you know, clap your hands for Tinkerbell, okay? We need to reestablish norms, and we need to, like, just say we are going to reestablish norms and hit that hammer over and over and over and over and over again.
So I agree with that, but I think the way that you reestablish norms is by making them fire you, is by taking a stand and saying,
fine. Yeah, you know, making them
like
fire
we,
you.
I am not going to go ahead with this policy. I'm also not going to quit.
Okay, all right.
And by the way, as someone who used to work for the federal government,
I like that.
It is a pain in the ass to fire an employee. There are a bunch of TPS reports or whatever you got to file.
Especially
it takes a lot
California.
Of documentation. You really can gum up the works of the federal bureaucracy by actually not playing along and resigning, and
rage
instead of
staying.
Making them fire you.
I like this rage staying. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, if you have a blog about that, will they be able to fire you for rage staying?
There are different rules about what you can say publicly. I really want an insider
blog from a rage stayer.
Yeah, well,
I can, like, save it all up.
An anonymous blog. I mean, I guess, you know, Tor is still legal. Yeah. Get some clever hackers on it.
Try to provide
anonymity.
No, the Russians
anonymity,
will hack
right?
that person in 10
have.
Minutes.
They already have.
My God.
Trump will ask the Russians to do it. The NSA will say no. GRU will cooperate.
Why is Trump asking for lists of people who support, like, who are...
just trying to get lists.
Right, he's trying to get lists of, like, the climate change people and whatnot in the government. I'm like, you should just ask Russia. I'm sure they have
He's cross-collateral. No, he already has it. He's cross-referencing.
Oh, God.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God. All right, well, but so Trump, HUD, the end of days. What can we, whether or not all of affordable housing falls apart because HUD dies or whatever, I mean, I think we can say that we can't necessarily control what's happening with HUD at the federal level. We can advocate for increasing funding for subsidized affordable housing, and we will continue to do that. But we in California have a limited impact on that. We're sort of in response, kind of working up what can California and specifically what can San Francisco do to support all of our subsidized affordable housing developers and housing units. You know, we have a bunch of policies that we're going to be putting forward. You know, everything from, like, adding transparency to where the in-lieu fees go, since it's a kind of a black box right now about when developers pay, rather than building their own affordable housing on site, they can pay into the mayor's office on housing, and that money can be spent to build affordable housing projects. you know, adding transparency to that since it's nobody knows how it's been spending. You know, you've given me some other ones, but I want you to tell us what you think we should be advocating for in 2017 to support subsidized affordable housing, and specifically Mission Housing, if you want us to, like, just get you the money.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well, if you guys want to take over Mayor's Office of Housing and everything, just to funnel everything to us, that'd be great. But bearing that not happening, I actually think a lot of what you're doing is the biggest thing you can do for us. I think the people at the federal level take heart, or they gain confidence in Forest Hill saying we don't want this thing, or Brisbane saying no, don't build this for us. And they're up at the federal level and they read this like Fox News report saying that they don't want it anyway. And then they're over there in Washington saying, well, then why would we fund it? Like, we do want to go spend this on the military. They don't want it out there anyway. So let's gut HUD because nobody likes it anyway. And I think that the normalizing of affordable housing for the people that maybe don't even qualify for it, all of us probably, that is the biggest thing that you can do. Making people realize that affordable housing is important. It serves a really large part of the population. Maybe it doesn't serve you specifically, but by serving this large part of the population, the police office gets more efficient, the, you know, hospitals get more efficient, you spend less money on ambulances. Like, all of this stuff goes into the city that makes the city have more money. Those are the things that I would ask that people do. Because, you know, the subsidies and all that, that's such a federal, like, wonky thing. Like, who knows? Sequester could happen. The government could shut down for 6 months, no matter what you do. But normalizing affordable housing, making people realize that public housing that used to exist, the giant concrete boxes that no one wanted to live in, those are gone. Like, we don't build those anymore.
I'm going to so push back on that. I mean, like, there are plenty of people who were ecstatic to move into those giant concrete boxes because they were living in dilapidated housing.
They were, agreed. But, like, then they lived there for a generation, and we ignored them for 40 years.
And it was the ignoring them, though. But that was the thing, though. It was the ignoring them.
But the people in the neighborhoods that don't want affordable housing now.
Yeah,
they saw the ignoring. They saw the government then blow those buildings up 40 years ago. And they're saying, well, what's the point? We supported it back then, and then they just blew it up, and they didn't run it well.
Well, so I don't know if they supported it back then. Yes. They probably didn't want it. I mean, they supported it back then because they were living in the suburbs, and it was happening in the inner
I'll give you
of
that.
The city.
Fine. They didn't support it, but it happened. It got built.
Right.
And then the government just had to blow it up 30 years later because they didn't run it well. This is what I mean. This is what people in Forest Hill think is coming, and it's not. This is what people in Brisbane think would be built, or people in Lafayette. Like, that's not what is going to get built.
So I hear. So I've got a question for you. As a nonprofit affordable housing developer, why should we be focusing most of our energy on trying to get new construction built nonprofit affordable housing instead of saying expand the voucher program?
Well, right now. Because the vouchers, there's so many legal protections for landlords to just say, I don't want a voucher. You can expand the vouchers all you want.
We could change it at the state level.
Right, but that's not, I mean, that's not what you said. Just to expand the voucher program?
Okay, but that's
not part of it. Say it's illegal to expand.
Source of income, ban source of income discrimination. State that, or actually, I'm sorry.
I think
source of income discrimination is already banned in California, getting a voucher is not considered a source of income. If we change that and stated that,
that'd be amazing.
You may not discriminate based on whether or not you get a voucher or not. And like there are plenty of folks, including me, who have talked to people in Sacramento about this. Like, this is like a popular idea among all sorts of housing wonky people. That said,
that
though,
there
aren't enough people that really want to push it.
That'd be a very important, well worth your time thing doing. Without a doubt. I guess I only say that the right now immediately supporting new construction is just that can happen. You know, that's already a policy. And we know now that if you build something and put especially homeless or supportive housing people in it, we know now that that is a much better use of the dollar than not building that housing.
So I hear you there, especially given that, like what you mentioned, you know, the police department, the health services, like they all sort of save money. A city does become more efficient if you adopt a housing first model.
Also, humans deserve housing too, right?
That's the thing, right? I hate getting into those things where you end up telling some, affordable housing, actually, even if you build 100% subsidized affordable housing, that also increases property values. And I'm like, God, really? Are we fucking doing this, because it reduces the police budget? I mean, great. I mean, I don't know. My thesis on life has been often the best things to do have many reasons why you should support mm-hmm. them, and that's a good thing. Yeah. But I hate having conversations with people where you're like saying we should support subsidized affordable housing because it's going to reduce the tax burden.
I think that a lot of the people who are against it say, but we need to support the police, but we need to support parks, but we need to support this. And I'm always, say.
Having
you would
a counter
be,
to every
you would
argument,
be supporting those
right?
things yeah. if
and,
you supported affordable
and housing. And I think, yeah, both of you, great points. My question is, though, let's say that we can ban source of income discrimination for real to include vouchers. So let's say that we have $2 billion a year to spend on affordable housing statewide in California. It's just a number I just made up. It seems to me that, assuming that we had like YIMBY policies and could actually build housing, it would be a much better use of funds to provide vouchers instead of expensive new construction building.
Without a doubt, that it'd be great. I'm not disagreeing with you.
Yeah.
If you want to go make that happen, that's awesome.
But right now that's like a Prop 13 where it's like you have to start saying that, and we should start saying that more loudly. I think, we're going to be putting out on the website a whole like bucket of policies that we're just generally for. But I think it's just like having things on the Democratic Party plank where it's like it really doesn't fucking matter, but you put it out there and you start the conversation and you force people. Yeah. Like we're not going to be able to do this for a long while.
So absolutely. But what I did want to say as well is, I think that is true. It is more efficient to use money for vouchers. That said, I'm not even sure that's the correct policy, in part because of the political economy of the situation, right? If you give lots of money to vouchers, then okay, more low-income people, I think, will be helped. To me, that's real good. That said, what you're not doing is funding nonprofit affordable housing developers who have their own staff, people whose salaries are invested in maintaining a continuous flow of affordable housing. What you don't have is the same constituency to maintain those types of programs. Now, at the national level, that's not very powerful. In the state of California, it is, though.
Well, but wouldn't it be ironic if, because you've established this whole voucher system, that groups like the Apartment Association become addicted to the voucher funding, then you have landlords who are advocating for increasing funding to
That'd
vouchers.
Be awesome.
That would be such a fun inversion.
The voucher is, it does, yeah. I vote for the voucher after we've talked.
Okay.
I really hope we don't get your developer card taken away after saying that. Sam.
No, he knows that it's like a Prop 13 pipe dream, and it's like going to be 20 years.
I don't think it's a pipe dream.
Ago,
I mean,
Sam
like,
the same
that was the whole 15
idea. Years ago.
The thing is, no, this was the whole idea behind Section 8. Like, this isn't like a new idea that I've had. This is like liberal wonks doing the math, saying that actually we can help out more low-income people if we provide vouchers instead of if we do all this new construction building.
Yeah, although
we get to put them in integrated neighborhoods as well.
All right. Well, with that, I think we're going to close it out.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. We're going to be having the ADEM elections on Saturday and Sunday. So look it up. We'll include it in the show notes. And other things, we're having the monthly YIMBY party meeting on Wednesday. So come down. We're going to have a big whiteboarding sesh to talk about what our sort of messaging for the coming year is going to be.
Cool.
And there's going to be lots more fun stuff. So stay tuned. And this is where the music goes.
Happy New Year.